We begin with Isaiah, and A is some comments on Isaiah himself, Isaiah the prophet. The meaning of the name Isaiah is salvation is of Yahweh. You see, Isaiah, the name comes from the root Yashah and Yahweh, Isaiah. Salvation is of Yahweh, or Yahweh is salvation, is the meaning of the name. It occurs in several places in the Old Testament. Other than Isaiah, as the name of an individual that quite clearly is not the same as the Isaiah of the book of Isaiah. For example, 1 Chronicles 3:21. You read there, the descendants of Hananiah, Pelatiah and Yeshiah. That Yeshiah is the same as Isaiah. It's just transliterated differently. In 1 Chronicles 25:3, you read, a list of names. Yeah, it's in there. It's that Yeshiah again, the same as the other one. But it's this, in the Hebrew, it's the same as Isaiah. And down in verse 15, the eighth to Yeshiah, his sons and relatives. So it does occur elsewhere. Thus, when you look at Isaiah 1:1, he's further identified as the son of Amoz. I think I discussed this when we looked at Amos. See, the vision concerning Judah and Jerusalem that Isaiah, son of Amoz, A-M-O-Z, the Isaiah, the prophet, is the son of Amoz, which is in the Hebrew Amos with a tzadi and an aleph, whereas Amos is an ayin, and a samik. So there's the difference. This is English AMOZ, and this is AMOS. We don't make much distinction the way we pronounce an Aleph or a Sadi and a Sami. But
Isaiah, son of Amoz, or Amoz in the Hebrew. We don't know anything about Amoz. There is a rabbinical tradition that can't be verified, that Amoz was the brother of King Amaziah of Judah. If that's the case, then Isaiah would have been a nephew of the king. But there's no real substantiating evidence for that other than a Jewish tradition. It seems that Isaiah lived in or near Jerusalem, because much of the setting when it appears for the various prophecies that it gives are near Jerusalem, particularly if you look at chapter 7. You read verse 3, the Lord said to Isaiah, go out, you and your son Shear Jashub, to meet Ahaz at the end of the aqueduct of the upper pool on the road to the washerman's field. Out near the location of a water system that supplied water for Jerusalem. And in the time of Hezekiah later, when the Assyrians attacked Jerusalem and surrounded, Isaiah is called for by Hezekiah, and he seems to be in or near Jerusalem throughout most of the book. We know he was married and had at least two sons who were given symbolic names. The one there we just noticed in Isaiah 7:3. The Lord said to Isaiah, "Go out, you and your son, Shear-Jashub." Shear-Jashub means the remnant will return. Shear being remnant, and Yashub coming from Shub to return. So the remnant will return. And of course, that carries a message. Really carries the message that, first of all, you're going to go be forced out of the land. Exile is going to come, but a remnant will return. So judgment is coming, but beyond judgment there's hope. A remnant will return. The other name of the other son that's given in chapter 8, you read in verse 1, the Lord said, "Take a scroll, write on it, and with an ordinary pen, Maher Shalal Hashbaz. And I will call in Uriah the priest and Zechariah son of Jebrekiah as a reliable witness for me. I went into the prophetess, she conceived and gave birth to a son. The Lord said to me, name him Maher Shalal Hashbaz." That's a good name if any of you are looking for a name for a son. The meaning of Maher Shalal Hashbaz is hasten the booty, speed the spoils. Hasten the booty, speed the spoil. I notice the NIV note here says it means quick to the plunder, swift to the spoil. But something of that sort. Hasten the booty, speed the spoil. Now again, that carries a message. If you go over to chapter 10, verses 5 and 6, you really get a play on the name of Maher Shalal Hashbaz, because in 5 and 6, Isaiah says, "Woe to the Assyrian, the rod of my anger, in whose hand is the club of my wrath. I send him against a godless nation." That is, the Lord is using Assyria against Israel as a rod in his hand to bring judgment and punishment. "I dispatch him against a people who anger me." Then notice the next phrase, "to seize loot and snatch plunder." They're the same words as Maher Shalal Hashbaz. To seize loot and snatch plunder. The Assyrians are going to come and plunder Israel, to trample them down like mud in the streets. But this is not what he intends. In other words, the Assyrian is looking out for his own interests. But behind Assyria's own interests, God is using Assyria as an instrument of judgment. And so the name Maher Shalal Hashbaz is really anticipating that judgment that is coming at the hands of the Assyrian. Now, Isaiah prophesied, as you notice in the first verse, during the rains, first chapter, first verse, a vision concerning Judah and Jerusalem that Isaiah son of Amos saw during the reigns of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. He prophesied during the time of Uzziah, southern kingdom, Judah, Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, Hezekiah. Dating of these reigns is somewhat complex because there appear to be a series of co-regencies. The green dates here include the co-regencies, the black dates the sole reign. I want to get into the details of that chronological thing, but you're running here from 767 down to 695, the end of Hezekiah's reign. Rather lengthy period of time. However,
There is a, again, a Jewish tradition, a rabbinic tradition, that Isaiah was killed in the time of the following king after Hezekiah, in the time of Manasseh. The Jewish tradition is Manasseh was a very wicked king, of course. Isaiah fled from some of Manasseh's men. He hid in a tree, a hollow tree, which his men proceeded to cut down, and in so doing they cut Isaiah too. And some see an allusion to that in Hebrews 11:37, where it speaks of these heroes of the faith, and it speaks of being sawn asunder. Hebrews 11:37 says, they were stoned, they were sawed in two. They were put to death by the sword. They went about in sheepskins and goatskins. Now, the interesting thing about that tradition is that it still sees Isaiah around in the time of Manasseh, even though that superscription says, Uzai, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. And it seems there's good basis to conclude that Isaiah did survive the end of Hezekiah's reign and did live in the time of Manasseh. And the reason I say that is that in chapter 37-38, you read, one day while he was worshiping in the temple of his god Nisroch, this is speaking of Sennacherib, the Assyrian king, his sons, Adramelech and Sharazer, cut him down with the sword, and they escaped to the land of Ararat, and Esarhaddon and his son succeeded him as king. You have a reference to the succession of Esarhaddon to Sennacherib after Sennacherib's death. And we know from Assyrian records that Sennacherib died in 681. And that's a pretty firm date. And you can see from this that that is into the time of Manasseh. Now again, it depends on, you know, co-regency or sole reign. But that's into the time of Manasseh quite clearly. Now many feel that perhaps the reason that Manasseh is not mentioned in the heading of 1:1 is that subsequent to the death of Hezekiah, who was a godly king, and the beginning of the reign of Manasseh, where he had a very wicked king, that Isaiah's public ministry ceased. In fact, many feel that maybe that, this is speculation, of course, but many feel that maybe that second part of the book, 40-66, which begins to speak about deliverance from exile, with the coming of Manasseh, the certainty of the judgment of the exile was clear. In fact, the book of Kings tells us that even after the time of Manasseh, when you had a reformation under the time of Josiah, that it was too little too late because of the wickedness of Manasseh. The judgment was inevitable. It could not be avoided. And many feel that what Isaiah did after the death of Hezekiah was withdraw from the public ministry and maybe had a more private kind of ministry to the godly element or remnant, produced his prophecies about deliverance from exile that was certain to come, which would have been comfort and provided a basis for hope for those godly people that remained in the land during this hard time. But it seems clear that Isaiah did live on into the reign of Manasseh, even though Manasseh is not mentioned in the heading to the book. Okay, B is historical setting for the book. Let's stop here and take a 10-minute break, and we'll come back and look at that historical setting. In chapter 6, with that
well-known vision of Isaiah, you have a dating. You read, in the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord seated on a throne, high and exalted. The year that King Uzziah died was 739. That's an important date in this sense, that the death of Uzziah really marked the end of a period of prosperity and political strength for Judah. Remember, time of Uzziah in the south, Israel was quite prosperous. It paralleled the time of Jeroboam. Well, Jeroboam would have been just above this. That's 752. Jeroboam the second in the northern kingdom was a time of prosperity for the north. But that period was ending. Assyria, who had really threatened Israel, we discussed this last quarter with the background of the book of Jonah. Assyria had threatened Israel about a century earlier, during the time of Ahab and Jehu. You remember Jehu, that was 840, about a century earlier. Jehu paid tribute to Shalmaneser of Assyria, Shalmaneser III. There's a black obelisk has a picture of Jehu kneeling, paying tribute to Shalmaneser. That's a century earlier. Assyria threatened Judah at that time, but then Assyria had gone into decline. Assyria was pressed from the north by those Urartu people. And for a time, Syria had troubled, not Assyria, but Syria, Damascus, that area, had threatened Israel. But Syria also was weakened, so that when you come to the time of Uzziah and Jeroboam, there was a period of power and prosperity for Israel because both Syria and Assyria were weak. But that was all ending. Assyria was now again to rise in power, an attempt to extend her influence and control over other peoples. And that began with Tiglath-Pileser III. 745 to 727. Tiglath-Pileser III begins what's known as the Neo-Assyrian Empire, and you have that succession of rulers in Assyria: Tiglath-Pileser III, Shalmaneser V, Sargon II, and then Sennacherib. From Assyrian records, we learn that Tiglath-Pileser fought in northern Syria against a league of kings, among whom was Aziahu. Of Ehuda. Aziahu of Ehuda. Most people think that is Uzziah. You know, Uzziah had two names. Sometimes he was called Azariah. Either Azariah or Uzziah. And that Aziahu, many think, was Uzziah. That's not absolutely certain, but many think it was Azariah or Uzziah, same person, of Judah. And Tiglath-Pileser says that these kings against whom he fought were forced to pay him tribute. From the Assyrian record, that dated at 743. Now, there's nothing said of that in the Old Testament, but 743. He took tribute from a coalition of kings, among whom was perhaps Uzziah. That is the third year of Tiglath-Pileser's reign. You see, that's early on in the time of Tiglath-Pileser. In another of his annals, he speaks of taking tribute from Menahem of Samaria. And you see, if you go over the northern kingdom, That's the same time. Menahem of Samaria, as Uzziah, at least it overlaps. And if you look at 2 Kings 15:19, here you do have a biblical reference. You read there, then Pul, P-U-L, which is the Babylonian name for Tiglath-Pileser. Tiglath-Pileser being the Assyrian name, but the Babylonians called him Pul. He's referred to as Pul here in Kings. Then Pul, king of Assyria, invaded the land, and Menahem gave him 1,000 talents of silver to gain his support and strengthen his own hold on the kingdom. Menahem exacted this money from Israel. The year of that is not known precisely, but Albright puts it at 738. Teeley puts it at 743.
Whereas Teeley puts it at the same time as this other tribute, but Albright 738, a little bit later.
In any case, you can see that under Tiglath-Pileser, pressure again is beginning to be exerted on Israel from the Assyrians. Tiglath-Pileser says, as for Menahem, I overwhelmed him, and he fled like a bird. Alone, I returned him to his place. Gold, silver, linen garments, and multicolored trimmings I received from him. And if you look in your bibliography, I think I've under Roman 1b, I have A-N-E-T. That A-N-E-T is the standard collection of extra-biblical texts, ancient Near Eastern texts, pages 25 to 29. If you want to look at some of these Assyrian annals from this time. But the point is, time of Uzziah, early in the time of the ministry of Isaiah, Assyria begins to rise to power, begins to put pressure on both the northern and southern kingdom. The next significant thing, as far as historical context, is I've put some key dates here. 734, the Syro-Ephraimitic War.
734, see, this tribute was 738, or 4 years later, we're down to 734.
The Syro-Ephraimitic War is Syria and Ephraim, the northern kingdom, attacking Judah. And that's the historical background for the prophecies in Isaiah 7 through 11. Israel and Syria attack Judah with the purpose of putting a puppet king on the throne in Judah, getting rid of Ahaz. You turn to Isaiah 7. You read in verse 5. Aram. Now, Aram. Let me make a comment on that. When you read the NIV, you will read Aram. When you read the King James, you will read Syria. They're the same. Aram is really better, I think, because that's the way it appears in Hebrew. In Hebrew, it's Aram, it's Aram. The term Syria is a shortened form of Assyria. And it really comes from Greek terminology. When Alexander and his forces came east and came into that area, the western part of what had been Assyrian land, the area around Damascus, the Greeks called Syria, a shortened form of Assyria. And that terminology came down through tradition into our English version. But I think many people confuse Syria and Assyria. Very easy to do. So it's probably better and certainly closer to the Hebrew terminology to speak of the area around Damascus as Aram
And in the area further to the east, in the Tigris-Euphrates area, as Assyria, in the northern part of the Tigris-Euphrates area. But when you see Isaiah 7:5 says, Aram, Ephraim, and Ramaliah's son have plotted your ruin. Let us invade Judah, let us tear it apart, divide it among ourselves, and make the son of Tabeel king over it. Yet this is what the Sovereign Lord says, it will not take place. What is being referred to there is this attempt by the northern kingdom, which here is referred to as Ephraim, and Syria, Aram, who put their own man on the throne of Judah in place of Ahaz. Ahaz is very concerned about that. And what Ahaz did in order to seek help, and he concluded an alliance with the Assyrians, and Isaiah condemned him to that. And that's the context of chapter 7. Isaiah says that dependence on Assyria ultimately is going to bring trouble and sorrow. And eventually Assyria, who Ahaz turned to, is going to take the northern kingdom into exile. And also put pressure on the southern kingdom, Judah. And that was realized not that long later. See, we're talking 734. 721, Samaria is gone. And it's not too long after that that Sennacherib is laying siege to Jerusalem. And if it wasn't for God's intervention, Judah would have been gone. So that alliance with Assyria was certainly a disastrous thing. But that's the next important event, 734, that Syro-Ephraimitic War, as far as historical background to the messages of the prophet Isaiah. 732, 2 years later, another key event, capture of Damascus by Assyria. In 732, Tiglath-Pileser took Damascus. And even though he didn't take the northern kingdom immediately, look at 2 Kings 15:30. 2 Kings 15:30 says, we'll go back to 2 Kings 15:29. In the time of Pekah, king of Israel, Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, came and took Ejon, Abel-Beth-Makeh, Genoa, Kadesh, and Hazor. Those are areas way in the north of Israel. He took Gilead and Galilee, including all the land of Naphtali, and deported the people to Assyria. Then Hoshea, son of Elah, conspired against Pekah, son of Remaliah. He attacked and assassinated him, and then succeeded him as king in the 20th year of Jotham, son of Uzziah. So you have a succession by virtue of a court revolution and intrigue where Hoshea conspires against Pekah and takes the throne in Judah. Now the interesting thing is, I thought I had a quote here. I don't. And I didn't bring the book with me. But the interesting thing is, in ancient Near Eastern texts, when you look at the annal of Tiglath-Pileser, he says that he put Hoshea on the throne in Judah. You see, that gives you somewhat of a fuller picture of what's going on here in verse 30. It says in 2 Kings 15:30, Hoshea, son of Elah, conspired against Pekah. But he must have done that, you see, with Assyrian backing, so that Hoshea was Assyria's man on the throne. Tiglath-Pileser makes a claim in his annals that he's the one that put Hoshea on the throne of Judah. But what you see is Assyria is beginning to move. They capture Damascus, and they're moving, putting pressure on the northern kingdom, taking some of their towns, and even
disrupting the rule there and putting their own man on the throne in the Northern Kingdom. Next important event, see 10 years later, is the capture of Samaria by Assyria. And that's the downfall of the Northern Kingdom. Hoshea apparently was put on the throne by Tiglath-Pileser, but after a time he revolted. And that caused Shalmaneser, who was Tiglath-Pileser's successor, that caused Shalmaneser and then his successor Sargon to besiege Samaria for 3 years. And you read of that in 2 Kings 17, beginning at verse 3. Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, came up to attack Hoshea, who had been Shalmaneser's vassal and paid him tribute. But the king of Assyria discovered that Hoshea was a traitor, for he had sent envoys to So, king of Egypt, and he no longer paid tribute to the king of Assyria as he had done year by year. Therefore, Shalmaneser seized him, put him in prison. The king of Assyria invaded the entire land, marched against Samaria, and laid siege to it for 3 years. In the ninth year of Hoshea, king of Assyria, captured Samaria, deported the Israelites to Assyria. He settled them in Halah. And verse 7 says, all this took place because the Israelites had sinned against the Lord their God. They'd broken the covenant. If you go over to chapter 18, which is a discussion of the rule of Hezekiah, southern kingdom. You notice verse 9 says, in Hezekiah's fourth year, which was the seventh year of Hoshea, son of Elah, king of Israel, Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, marched against Samaria, laid siege to it. At the end of 3 years, the Assyrians took it. So Samaria was captured in Hezekiah's sixth year, which was the ninth year of Hoshea, king of Israel. Okay, next significant event, 701. Siege of Jerusalem by Sennacherib. See, if you go down to verse 13 of that chapter, in the 14th year of King Hezekiah, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, attacked all the fortified cities of Judah and captured them. And over in 2 Kings 19... towards the end of the chapter, you read of the siege of Jerusalem by Sennacherib and the intervention of God to deliver the city. You read in 2 Kings 19:35, that night the angel of the Lord went out and put to death 185,000 men in the Assyrian camp. When the people got up the next morning, there were all the dead bodies. So Sennacherib, king of Assyria, broke camp and withdrew. He returned to Nineveh and stayed there. So in 701, that siege to Jerusalem, but divine intervention to deliver, which had been prophesied, as we will notice, by Isaiah. Now, he had prophesied long before that when Ahaz, you see, look back up here, time of Ahaz, when you make that alliance with Assyria, Assyria is going to overflow the land like a flood. But in the midst of that, there's going to be a deliverance. And you find later, even in Isaiah's life, during the time of Hezekiah, the fulfillment of prophecies that Isaiah made in the context of that alliance with Assyria and Tanakh. Yeah.
I have a question. The 17th day says that Hezekiah sent this to Assyria, along with the
it does. Verse 15, Hezekiah gave him all the silver that was found in the temple. Would seem like it. Seemed like that
seem like what you see often in politics and relations like that is just greed. Syrians will take what they can get, but it's never enough. You know, just go on and take more in spite of you're paying the tribute. Now, what may be involved as well is Hezekiah, even though he paid the tribute, made certain overtures to Babylon, which was generally under Assyrian control, but still a distinct element within the Assyrian area of control. And that may have been interpreted as a revolt by Hezekiah that prompted that attack, even though he had paid tribute. Yes, yes.
I just am wondering if he had spent all the tribute to the material, was there for the Babylonian, but it's now he said he showed them all the treasures and what happened. But then that's what they always see when they grab all the treasures.
Yeah. Well, I'd have to try to check the. There are a lot of difficult problems of chronology in putting together the accounts in both. You know, there's a parallel to this in Isaiah 36 to 39. And it seems quite clearly that the sequence of these narratives is arranged more on a topical or logical basis than it is on a chronological basis. So, part of the problem, I think, is sorting out what the exact sequence of those things is. You see, in the Isaiah account, that envoy to Babylon comes at the end, which, and then as you're saying, if the tribute was all gone, what would there have been left to show? But it seems that that envoy must have been earlier, and that it's put at the end in order to make the transition in the flow of thought to the second part of the book, where Israel is in Babylonian captivity. So it seems like there's more a logical ordering of material than there is a chronological order. Now, I'm not sure I can sort all that out for you right here at the moment, but I think that's probably a factor in the questions you're raising. In other words, you see, in chapter 18 of 2 Kings, those first 16 verses sort of give you a summary of the reign of Hezekiah. And then you go back, and when you start at verse 17, Sennacherib threatens Jerusalem, you have an account of that specific event. And that may chronologically, you see, fit differently in that whole flow of things. Not necessarily that it's happened subsequent to everything that happened that's mentioned earlier. Okay. As far as those are key dates then, 734, 732, 721, 701. When we move beyond that, you come into the time of Manasseh. That was a time of great apostasy in the southern kingdom. Manasseh is pictured as the worst of the kings of Judah in the whole history of Judah. And during the time of Manasseh, the exile of Judah becomes certain, to be unavoidable. And it seems that it's at that time that Isaiah turns his message to the godly remnant to bring words of comfort, consolation, and hope, looking beyond the judgment that was sure to come. In other words, the exile is definite, but it's not forever. There will be an end to it. There will be a remnant that will return. Okay, that's in general historical setting for the prophecies of Isaiah. Let's go on to C, which is structure of the book.
Isaiah is a difficult book to outline. And I'm following here a system that I picked up from Dr. McRae to try to find some principle of organization of the book, break it down into the blocks of material that can be found within the whole of the book. As you know, the book contains 66 chapters, so that first line represents the book of Isaiah, 66 chapters. If you're going to start dividing it, there's a major dividing point, and that is this section, 36 to 39. Because 36 to 39 is distinctly different in form from the rest of the book. 36 to 39 is historical narrative. In fact, it parallels the historical narrative of the book of Kings in the time of Hezekiah and this threat of Sennacherib. Isaiah 36-39 and that section of 2 Kings around 17 and 18 is what we've just been looking at, is very similar. So that is a distinct section that naturally divides the book into two parts, 1 to 35 and 40 to 66. 1 to 35, 40 to 66, both being prophetic discourse as distinct from historical narrative. Now, most of the material of 1 to 35 is made up of discourses given in the time of Ahaz or even prior. Some of it in the time of Uzziah. So 1 to 35 is early in the ministry of Isaiah, you might say, relatively early. Most of it around the time of Ahaz. Chapters 36 to 39 is not prophetic discourse, but it's historical narrative dealing with the time of Hezekiah. And what you see in 36 to 39 is the fulfillment of some of Isaiah's prophecies in the first part of the book. And particularly that prophecy that even though Assyria is going to come in and be an instrument of God's judgment, Assyria is not going to completely overrun the land, and it doesn't. Isaiah said Assyria would attack, but Judah would be spared a complete defeat, and that's exactly what happened, you see, in that section of 36 to 39. You see how that worked out historically. Now, I'll come back and say something about 40 to 66 later, but let's work with this section 1 to 35 and try to break it down further. And I think if you do, you'll find that the most natural divisions are as follows. First, chapters 1 to 6, that forms a sort of unit in its own right. Then chapters 7 to 12. Then chapters 13 to 23, then 24 to 27, then 28 to 35. Now those are the divisions. Now, what sets each one of them apart? Let's look at them. I'd say the clearest units are 13 to 23 and 24 to 27. That's why I've set them above the line. 13 to 23 is a group of prophecies of judgment on foreign nations. Prophecies of judgment on foreign nations. So in that section, Isaiah is not directing his message so much to Israel itself, but to the surrounding nations. If you look at 13:1, you can see how this works quite quickly. An oracle concerning Babylon, which Isaiah, son of Amoz, saw. 15:1, an oracle concerning Moab. 17, an oracle concerning Damascus. 18, woe to the land of whirring wings along the rivers of Cush.
which sends envoys by sea, papyrus boats over the water. It's prophecy against Cush, and Cush is probably Ethiopia, to the south of Egypt. 19, an oracle concerning Egypt. So you see, you're in this section of prophecies concerning foreign nations, and that sort of sets them apart as a unique section. When you get to 24 to 27, that section is often called Isaiah's Little Apocalypse. Isaiah's Little Apocalypse. What you see in 24 to 27 is a collection of prophecies that speak of a great judgment that's coming on the nations of the earth. All who oppose God will suffer this judgment. It seems to be quite global in scope. So that section, Isaiah's Apocalypse, those two sections pretty much set themselves apart from 1 to 6, 7 to 12, 28 to 35. When you come to 1 to 6, the clearest section is probably 7 to 12, and that, of course, leaves you 1 to 6. When you pulled out 13 to 23, 24 to 27, that leaves you with 1 to 12. But out of 1 to 12, 7 to 12 is a clear unit. 7 to 12 concerns that Syro-Ephraimic War and its aftermath. See, in 7, the Lord says to Isaiah, take your son, Shear-Jashub, go out and meet Ahaz, and confront him about this alliance he's made with Assyria. Instead of trusting in me, he's trusting in Assyria, and judgment is pronounced because of that. So 7 to 12 have a specific background and historical setting at Syro-Ephraimic War, and that sets itself apart as a unit. That unit is often called the Book of Emmanuel, and the reason for that is the prophecy of Isaiah 7:14. Because in Isaiah 7:14, in the context of that Syro-Ephraimic War, Isaiah says, the Lord's going to give you a sign, the virgin will conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel, God with us. And a lot of interesting questions about how you interpret that prophecy, how you relate it to that context, and at the same time see it as a messianic prophecy. We'll get into that when we look at it. But that well-known verse, Isaiah 7:14, has given a title to this section because it's right at the heart of that section, the Book of Emmanuel. That leaves, though, then, you see, from 1 to 12, that leaves you with 1 to 6. And 1 to 6 is much more general in nature. You can't pin it down to a specific historical setting like you can 7 to 12 with that Syro-Ephraimic War. It's quite general in nature, but it divides this way into three sections. And we're going to look at these. The character of the three sections are 1:1 to 2:5, 2:6 to 4:6, and 5:1 to 6:13. The character of those three sections is that you have pronouncement of judgment followed by a section that speaks of future blessing. The section that speaks of future blessing is in parentheses. So you see in 1:1 to 2:5, 2:1 to 4 speaks of future blessing. You have judgment and then future blessing. Then you go back in 2:6 to judgment again, but that's followed in 4:2 to 6 with another section of future blessing. Then you go back to judgment again in 5:1, but that's followed by blessing in 6:1 to 13, the blessing in that case being the call of Isaiah and the vision he sees and the commission to bring the word of the Lord to the people of Israel. So you see, the character of that material is judgment, blessing, judgment, blessing, judgment, blessing. And there are three sections there. We'll look at them in more detail and see how that works out. But that's the way it's structured. Now, that gives you then the way in which the material from 1 to 35 is organized. You can really break it down into these five sections. So it seems that the prophecies are grouped around either
Oh, I didn't mention 28 to 35. You but the prophecies are grouped around some kind of principle of organization, like prophecies against foreign nations, this eschatological apocalyptic judgment, Syro-Ephraimitic war, prophecies of judgment and blessing. 28 to 35, before we leave this, it's much like 7 to 12. And it seems like, although it's less explicit, it seems like it has the same general historical background, 28 to 35, that is the Syro-Ephraimitic war. But it seems like whereas 7 to 12 is addressed more to the king, to Ahaz, who was an unworthy representative of the house of David, sitting on the throne of Judah, that 28 to 35 is addressed more to the nobles of the land, the leadership apart from the king, the nobles of the land in that same general period of time. But it's very similar to the book of Emmanuel. All right, so that's the section 1 to 35. We notice 36-39 is historical narrative. Then you get 40 to 66, the last 27 chapters of the book. And the interesting thing is, the material here is, in some respects, quite different. Of course, that's the kind of thing that critical scholars appear to suggest that you have a different writer here. The material is quite different. Assyria, that is so prominent in the first part of the book, is now hardly mentioned. And in this section, the prophet turns his attention away from the sad conditions in Israel in the time of Manasseh and Ahaz, and he's looking forward not just to exile, but looking forward to release from exile, assuming that exile has already taken place. So Isaiah sees the exile as absolutely certain. And what he's concerned with in the second part of the book is not so much the coming of the exile, but with the end of the exile, the fact that the exile is not going to be forever. There will be deliverance from it. But what that means is whereas the first part of the book, 1 to 35, is concerned with warning of coming judgment and call to repentance, the second part of the book is quite different emphasis. That warning and coming judgment is not emphasized at all in the second part of the book. You have material of comfort, consolation, of future hope beyond exile. So it seems that Isaiah is now speaking to believers, giving them something to be passed on that would be of value in giving encouragement and hope to their descendants who actually experience those conditions of exile and judgment. Now, it's interesting that in this section, the 14th chapter, which is Isaiah 53, which is the central chapter, you see, of the 27, right in the middle of it, you have the climax towards which everything previous looks and from which everything subsequent is derived. Right in the heart of 40 to 66 is Isaiah 53. And what that portrays is the suffering of Christ, as described in Isaiah 53, the suffering of the servant. It's in the climax of a sequence of servant passages. But it depicts the suffering of Christ for the salvation of those who believe in him in just a beautiful, clear way. Now, that brings up a question that I think is an important one and an interesting one. And that question is, how does that messianic theme that climaxes there with the suffering of the servant, how does that relate to this whole focus of this section of Isaiah on deliverance from exile? What's the relationship between
this servant theme that climaxes in the death of this servant on behalf of his people.